Welcome, Austin, Al, and Jim. It's our 15th anniversary of Strategy Page being launched back in 1999. It's amazing that 15 years has gone by. We've talked, and I think we did it a little bit last year on this date, about the start of strategypage.com. But really, the genesis for it goes further back. Jim, you started a company back, and I'm not sure of the date. I thought it was 1969, but
it was 1969. I started a company that came to be called Strategy Page, and it published the military history magazine with a war game in it. I left in 1980. And the magazine is still around. It's gone through several owners, you know, since I departed. And occasionally somebody will come to me and say, let's start another, you know, S&T, Strategy and Tactics. And I explain to them that, you know, things have changed. You know, gaming has changed. And this is even before the web. Fast forward to 1999, and Dan comes to me and says, how about, you know, Strategy and Tactics on the web? In effect, you know, what Strategy Page turned into. And I came back with, I got a better idea. I've been having a problem with updating some of my books, especially How to Make War. First one came out in 82. And, of course, it's partly current events, partly history. And the current events aspect, you know, wears out after a while. And in 1985, Austin came to me and said, hey, why don't we do for wars what you did for hardware, you know, warfare in general, and that became the first edition of Quick and Dirty Guide to War. Now, we've since done four editions of each of those books. The last edition of Quick and Dirty Guide was in 2008, and the last edition of How to Make War was in 2003. But in 1999, there was a 1993 edition of How to Make War and a 96 edition of Quick and Dirty Guide. And I told Dan, I said, you know, this might be a great opportunity for me and Austin to basically keep up, you know, update these books regularly instead of doing it all at once, you know, to do a new edition. It's always a big hassle. I have less time. I got time. You know, the real world, the day job and everything was becoming more of a hassle. And so Dan says, fine. So I wrote up a proposal, and, you know, we hammered out what it would look like. And you can basically find that on the Wayback Machine. Just Google that. And the Wayback Machine only captured not the first edition, but I think one in December or November in 1990. You know, but that was the look of the first edition. In the early, and of course, the idea was initially we knew it would change. We said basically we're going to do updates of How to Make War and Quick and Dirty Guide using those two books. You know, the chapter layout for each of them, different categories that data covered. We would simply update. In addition, we would have military history, which Al would take care of. And we would also have war games and maybe even games in, you know, on the site. Now, things changed. Let me give my version of how this happened. First of all, we found out I was always a numbers guy, what they call a quant down on Wall Street. And with Strategy and Tactics, we did surveys, you know, one a month, opinion surveys, which our users, we later came to call the overeducated. They were hip to that. Several people came into Strategy, our offices, and would ask me, you know, where did you go to business school? And I said, I didn't. I just sort of invented it as I went along. You know, nothing hairy about, you know, statistics. But anyway, this idea of surveying and giving people what they want, or if you're lucky, give them what they don't know they want, worked very well. We really knew where we were going all along. And that system is still being used in the magazine Strategy and Tactics, which is now published by Knopfler out in California, to this day, successfully. And I said, you know, and with the internet, statistics are much easier to obtain because you don't really have to have surveys, because you get results, you know, in metrics, as they say, on web usage. We quickly found out that there was not a lot of interest in the war games, because that was always a small segment of the population, or his military history, which is really disappointing. But it shouldn't have been, because we were mostly covering contemporary and you know, well, contemporary military affairs. And I was, although I got out of Left Strategy Page in 1980, I think for about 18 months, again, that's a long story I won't go into, in 1989 and 1990, in which we did some interesting things. But one of the things I did was I specifically did a survey of people's, you know, preferences right after the Cold War ended. I took over before the wall came down, the Berlin Wall, and, of course, obviously before 1991 when the Soviet Union dissolved. But I was amazed, and I passed this finding around. Before the wall came down, the Cold War ended, people were very interested in contemporary military affairs, war games, or, you know, just general military history. After the Cold War ended, boom, that disappeared. You know, like by more than half. I haven't got the statistics in front of me, but they were astounding. And I let everybody else in the war games computer or manual games know this, and you could see, well, some of them figured it out themselves. This, you know, the types of games being published. There were far fewer contemporary games after the Cold War ended. Not completely gone, but less than before. And unfortunately for us, there was a general decline in interest in military history. Now, the interest of people who used to be into the Cold War and future wars and what have you did somewhat migrate to, you know, older wars, especially 19th century and World War II. But they were done. You know, it was a generational thing. By 1990, you know, World War II was becoming ancient history. You know, the most recent war was Vietnam, and soon to be, you know, the Gulf War in 1990-91. So we had to adapt. You know, it was obvious. The numbers were showing us. So all we had left of the history was Al's, you know, CIC, which is, continues to be popular, but that's basically just one section of, you know, a fairly large page. And the war games thing never really caught on because, well, it's more complicated than it looks. I suggested it to the CIA when they asked me for some advice in the 1990s. I explained it to them, and they were interested, but at that time, they were it was still illegal for them to do war games, even if they were to be used for, you know, rapid analysis. I was on an Army advisory board in the late 90s for the Army organization STRICOM at the time that developed, you know, training models and what have you in simulation and war games for the Army. And they thought it was interesting, but again, nobody ever, when they looked into the details of what it would take, it was decided that, maybe not. I still think it's a great idea, but I don't think it's, I don't, the numbers don't add up. It's not really practical for a giving away for free or even for selling for a small amount of money as an app because of the small size of the audience for that sort of thing. But there was a fairly large audience for what we currently do. And, of course, it was aided by, you know, there's a bright side to everything, including war. Every time there was a war, we quickly discovered, like Kosovo was the big war in 1999, and then of course there was, well, you can look at the history of current warfare, you know, contemporary warfare. Our audience grew and grew and grew by spikes. Every time there was a conflict, 2001, 2003, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of those people stuck around later. We got a lot of media attention. I was doing a lot of TV at that time. Although some, for whatever it means, you know, an appearance on Fox pulled in a lot more new users than an appearance on MSNBC. And this is before MSNBC became a shill for the Democratic Party. They were fairly even-handed in the early days, as was Fox. But anyway, we evolved over the years into what we are now. In the beginning, we were basically just updating the books, and that worked very well. Another guy who should be mentioned was Steve Cole. This goes back to 1979. This is one historical aspect you want to include. Back in 79, when I was running Strategy and Tactics, I was the editor-in-chief, I came up with the idea for a feature called FYEO. Sound familiar? For Your Eyes Only. And it was basically, the magazine came out every 2 months, it was contemporary military affairs, interesting bits. This later evolved into the book, Quick and Dirty Guide to War, and a whole series of books, which I did with Al. And they proved very popular, as did FYEO. But after I left Strategy and Tactics, FYEO was spun off and sold to another game developer and publisher, Steve Cole, to publish as a newsletter, which he did very successfully for, almost 2 decades. But at the time we were going to start, Strategy Page, somehow he got wind of it and said he wanted to get out of doing FYEO. It was a grind. He was doing it, I think, on a weekly basis, mailing it out. And so we got it very cheaply. Basically, we absorbed we took on a subscription debt. And he continued, for a small fee, to continue doing a lot of bits. And he did that for about 2 years until he eased himself out. And so in those first 2 years or so, he was doing most of the how to make war type stuff. And I and Austin were doing most of the wars updates. And so when he left, I and a few other people, just stringers as it were, contributors, took over the how to make war stuff. And the amount of material we devoted to the various categories of wars and what have you varied, basically depending on how much how much interest there was in our viewers. Now, one thing we do in the face of public opinion, as it were, is we cover a lot of wars that are not covered much in the mass media, simply because they are wars, they are conflicts. They're killing a lot of people. Most of the ones that we are a major source of information for a lot of people are the wars in Africa, but also Colombia, you name it. I mean, in my day job, I basically cover current events as it affects, currency and bond markets. That's another long story I can't get into. But anyway, so I had access to a lot of information on, what's going. The stuff I do every day is more risk management type stuff. Again, you can Google that, but it's basically in analyzing current events and determining what areas that are in conflict are still decent investments, or what areas that are not blown up yet are tumbling, into the pit, as it were. And what we do in Strategy Page is simply cover the ones that have gone boom. We do have a category for things that are bubbling and may blow up at any minute. But basically, we just cover the ones that are there, that exist. A lot of people are getting killed. There's a lot of fighting going on. But in many cases, the mass media doesn't cover it. Like I say, the wars in Africa, Congo, huge. Millions of people have died in the last 2 decades. Yet it gets very little coverage. Sudan's another one. And actually there's a whole bunch of them. Some of them have ended more or less, since we started covering them in 1999. In fact, when we started, the only wars we were covering were Russia, the Balkans, I went and checked. There were several things going. Remember, the Balkans was on fire, as it were, in the 1990s, because Yugoslavia, the former state of Yugoslavia, started coming apart in the early 90s. China, which was still, just not even getting as rambunctious as they are today. Congo, which we recognized, Austin and I recognized in our book, Quick and Dirty Guide to War, especially the previous two editions, it was getting huge. India, which never stopped fighting with Pakistan, and now, of course, the war with China has come back. Indonesia, which, that's, again, go look at our Indonesia section, it's complicated. Israel, again, the war with the Arabs started in 1947. The Arabs never give up. The Kosovo War, which was the big war, the only active, big war that the Western powers were involved in at that point. Again, part of the Balkan Wars. Sri Lanka, again, a war that was hardly covered at all. We covered it, but it had already been going on since the 80s. we covered it right until the end a few years ago, and a category called terrorism, which covered a lot of smaller conflicts, which have since petered out, other ones have taken their place, but that included, I know, in 1999, all of Peru and Ecuador, and a lot of other things, the nonsense, the war, as it were, in Ireland, with Northern Ireland, with the IRA, that was still going strong in 99, although they made sort of a peace in 97, and they didn't really, until 05, I think, make a thing that really allowed the British to start pulling their troops out. So it was a different world back then. One thing we have noted in the past 15 years, now especially that we do these every 6 months, we do a wars update, there has actually been a less fighting. I mean, there are more wars if you're just counting conflicts. That number changes. But the actual number of people being affected, killed and what have you, has been declining, you know, especially since the Cold War ended shortly. You know, that had already happened before we started a strategy page. But the 90s were supposed to be the period, you know, the end of history, all sorts of other, you know, nonsense, which didn't come true. But basically, a new world was evolving, one involving a lot of Islamic terrorism, which we were already covering. And, of course, now we have this basically a war with the Islamic world, which is at war with itself. Again, we cover all this in great detail in strategy page and have. Again, not the way the mass media does, because they look for simplified ways to describe things. They have to, because most people aren't going to spend as much time, you know, looking at headlines on the, you know, the TV or brief, you know, 2 minute stories. That's a big story on TV. And people don't read newspapers anymore, at least the young people. So you have to keep it short, which we did from the beginning. That was part of our, you know, plan, as it were, business plan. We mentioned that concise, to the point. And that's the way Austin and I had always written, and Al, the three of us came from strategy. Basically, the editorial model that we used in strategy page was the one I developed along with, you know, a bunch of other guys in the late 60s, early 70s, you know, with strategy and tactics, which always had a lot of appeal to people in the business. I'm talking about military, CIA, State Department, what have you. All through the time I was running strategy and tactics, again, because of our service, about 20% of our audience were people in the military and intelligence agencies and what have you. And at one point, the CIA was so impressed, they sent a guy up on official business. I mean, I knew a lot of guys in the agency, fairly senior people, you know, informally. But he sent up, you know, he had orders, he flashed his junior G-man badge, which they actually have. I don't think they use the shield anymore. But anyway, and what he wanted to do was get the official word, as it were, how our editorial policy, how we were able to take very complex issues and make them understandable, you know, in a short period of time. And the reason he needed that was, he says, we got to brief Congress all the time. And these guys got the attention span of newts, you know, well, but I don't know what term he used, but he was basically saying that these guys are busy. And if you don't get them, you know, in 60 seconds, their eyes glaze over and they forget the CIA was even there briefing them. And I basically gave them a lot of techniques, and they basically implemented this. One of the things they implemented was a classified news network, which literally they hired people, anchors and what have you, who could get a security clearance. And they basically gave, you know, a brief, you know, a few minute synopsis regularly. It was a special channel, a closed channel. Only people with high security clearance could get these news updates. And because they recognized, as we did, that in the 80s and 90s, you know, with the arrival of CNN, you know, cable, 24-hour cable news, and, of course, there was 24-hour radio news in the 60s, that, you know, the delivery methods for news were changing because people were changing on what they expected, what they would tolerate. So, you know, the old gray lady, the New York Times, and all the other record, the few other papers of record, you know, the pages and pages of documents, nobody was reading this stuff. I mean, as a kid in the 50s, you know, and a teenager in the late 50s, I remember I read newspapers and I said, God, why don't they boil it down? I mean, there's so much going on in the world after World War II that if you wanted to find it out, you know, you had so many other things to do, especially as a teenager, you wanted to boil down, and that bugged me. And so when I got the opportunity in the late 60s to start strategy and tactics, well, here's my chance. I had noticed that some people were doing that. Some books were coming out very, you know, little bits, a lot of bits and what have you, and that's exactly the thing we followed in the strategy, Dirty Little Secrets line series of books, and that was very popular. I mean, I asked people, and they told me, yeah, because I can sit down, boom, 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 read a few bits, close it, you know, and then come back to it later, and I haven't missed anything. And so this has been very successful, and actually you find this technique. I didn't invent it. Like I'm saying, I simply responded to the zeitgeist. Went with, you know, what people were willing to tolerate. And so far, we've been very successful. The only problem is, again, as I found out during the war games, we are the hobby of the overeducated. And there aren't that many of those, at least not that many overeducated people who are interested in military history and also have an affinity for math. The math angle is something that often gets overlooked. Now, in the manual war games, it was essential because you were playing these things. You didn't have software to do all the numbers crunching for you. The numbers crunching was not as heavy as in computer war games, but it was still there. And basically, you had to have a head for math. The math was not important just to be able to calculate odds and do little calculations to move the game along, but also to understand strategy. That's why we call it strategy and tactics. The essence of military analysis was counting things and then predicting. Again, that's why we cover stuff in strategy in strategy page, like predictive analysis and data mining, because that's where we come from. Basically, I and again a number of other people invented a whole new form of military analysis, which the Pentagon quickly stumbled upon. Again, that's a whole other story, but this led to basically, you know, strategy page. We used the same approach. There's a lot of numbers. And, of course, you see a lot of numbers. Whenever you pick up a strategy page article, there's always a numeric reference point. You know, how many of what? In our guidelines for our writers, contributors, we say no speculation. We're not speculating. We're dealing with things that have happened. Tell people, you know, just the facts, ma'am, you know, like the old 1950s Hepburn show. And by doing that, basically, we zero in on what is happening, what recently happened, what it means most likely, not a lot of guesswork, but, you know, based upon this, these trends do exist. They do tend to follow, you know, the past is prologue to the future is very true. And we point that out again and again in strategy page items. And people are into this, but there are not a lot of them. So we're still hitting a fairly, you know, small audience. I think the most we had, again, in one of the War Fever periods was like 500,000, you know, regular users. It fluctuates, you know, so peace kills us, but hey, I'm all for it, even despite whatever the cost. And that's basically where we started and where we are.
Yeah. Now, Austin, when did you get involved with Jim?
Man, what a question! For a lot of reasons, I'm really amused by that because for a number of reasons, I played a number of Jim's games starting when I was in high school, and I was some of that was before Avalon Hill put design credits on some of the games. Now, and a quick sketch on me. Jim and Al may remember me telling them this story years ago. It's not one I tell frequently. I designed my first war game, Dan, when I was 8 years old. It's because I was dissatisfied with simply reading, and I still love them, the American Heritage series on the Civil War, and because you're 8 years old and it's 1959, you're on the cusp of the 100th anniversary of the beginning of the American Civil War, 1860-1861, and we were inundated with stories and publications, and some of those stories that were history books, and I would say they were aimed at young adults. They were very good, but they were just inadequate, because I would ask the question, gee, what if, and could you change things? And I was also aware of some of books that were actually, there was this became a short series on TV, and there was a best-selling book by this title, What If the South Had Won at Gettysburg? And Al may recall that book. It was and it did very well, and it was quite controversial, and it would lead to what if the South had won the Civil War? And I had a good friend in third grade with me, and we sat there. He had the same kind of interest, and we took a piece of poster board and saw a model of what a game looked like. And I want to say it was maybe in the back of Life magazine. It may have been in the back of a National Geographic. And we drew a huge map of the eastern United States. Now, I understand we're two kids from Texas, so Texas was on there. And the joke is, I remember my friend's mother laughing about it, we couldn't get Florida in, so we had this huge canal that cut across northern Florida for our boats on this. Now, I'm just saying that I don't even remember how that game worked, but we had little Civil War soldiers, and we'd fight these battles, and we had a lot of dice, and we had rules that would kind of change. So, but when the Avalon Hill games began appearing, good gosh. Yes, I liked the Beach Boys, Dan. And I went and got my obligatory copy of Louie Louie by the Kingsmen, but I really liked the games. So I did not know that I was playing Jim Dunnigan games when they were coming out in the late 60s. But I did when Strategy and Tactics started, because I got copies of those early issues. Was a huge fan of them. Now, I'll track this forward. Jim and I think this is one of those coincidences that, you know, how do you explain it? Late 1976, I guess, early 1977, my boss, I'm in a first lieutenant, and I'm in a assistant actually, I'm in an assistant G3 slot handling several jobs that I probably was at least rank-wise unqualified for, but I was doing, and I had a Texas Aggie colonel as the G3 of the 1st Infantry Division forwards. It was really a midget division, a reinforced brigade group, but we had a G-level staff. And he comes in along with with his deputy, and they have a game with a camouflage cover on it, and it's a war game. And I said, Austin, we got this order from 7th Corps, and actually it's from you, sir. We need somebody to play test these. And there were actually about three officers or four officers, I should say, on the staff, primarily in G2 and G3, that had wargaming backgrounds. One of them, a tremendous wargaming background, I got to work with two of these guys. We basically used some of those techniques to do the early planning for what became Reforger 1976. So I've used these techniques for real exercises. By the way, a quick sketch on that. That was a tri-national operation, Dan. We had a German brigade group, a Canadian brigade group, U.S. Cut our forces and formed them into operating as a brigade, and then used our headquarters plus some add-on elements to portray the bad guys. We were the Orange Force, meaning we were the Soviets. But we used put together a huge map complex and gamed options. Sorry. Right.
Now, for those of our listeners that weren't alive at that time,
okay,
which are numerous,
all right,
that was an exercise to show how Europe could be reinforced.
Reforger was redeployment of forces to Germany, okay? And when I said that our unit, the reason I went into this, I just want to tell you is that these analytic tools that Jim talks about. And Jim, by the way, when he said that he has his analytics were picked up, they were. You can ask Andy Marshall, of head of the Office of Net Assessments. Mr. Marshall told me that on several occasions. Remember, remember or not, the folks out there, I worked as a special consultant in his shop for a little over four years on strategic wargaming. But the all right, so we'd use these things. Well, this game shows up, and what it was Firefight. It was a Firefight, which was a Simulations Publications Inc. game, and it had been done for the Department of Defense, and they wanted somebody to play test it. So I ran a play test, you know, there in Germany, and I actually was the core study that got bucked on up to U.S. Army Europe, and through SACUR, and finally to the Pentagon, because I got word from my boss a couple of months later, said, "Hey, hey, Austin, basically that report you did went straight on up." I said, "Thank you, sir." And he says, "No, well, he looked at it, and we talked about the results on it, but I ran a number of play tests on the game." Just for historical purposes, one of the most interesting comments came from the anti-tank platoon's sergeant and the first of the 26th Infantry, and I happened to be playing him. I was playing the bad guys, and I was playing the Russians, and he was playing the U.S. on this. And he says to me, "Hey, you know, Lieutenant Bay, you know what's wrong with this game?" And I said, "What, Sarge?" And he says, "The weapons shoot too far." I just meant that, and we figured out, you know, what do you mean by, well, you didn't get too many shots in Germany, especially some of the places we were deployed, where you could fire a tow 3,200 meters or 4,000. I mean, that's you just didn't have that. That's what he was talking about. And I'd also been in the 11th Armored Cav up at the border, and I know what the engagement range is there. Well, it turned out, toggle on to 1979, 1980. I'm out of the active component of the service. I'm in graduate school at Columbia in New York. And I wrote SPI a note and said I want to do an article on chemical warfare, because I'd done chemical warfare work there. And I'd been to one of the chemical defense courses, and I thought there was kind of a empty space in treatment of chemical warfare. Plus, as you guys know, I'm very interested in World War I, and that was a chemical war. And I didn't get an email back. I got a phone call from Jim. I happened to be at my grand uncle's house out in Bernardsville, New Jersey. And he called and he says, "Hey, I don't know who you are. I don't know what you've done. Why don't you come on down to our down there on Lower East Side, 21st, 23rd Street, East, you know." And so I did. And ended up doing that article on chemical warfare. Now, slight update on how the origins of A Quick and Dirty Guide to War. I proposed to my literary agent at the time, Perry Knowlton of Curtis Brown Limited, a book that I said would be like A Quick and Dirty Guide to Armed Conflict in the 80s, and it would use simulations to look at current and potential wars. And he says, "That's a great idea, Austin," but he says, "You've never done a book like that, and you're getting a doctorate in comparative lit, and do you know somebody you can collaborate with?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I sure do." So this was late 83. So I called Jim. I said, "Hey, Jim, take a look at this." And Jim says, "Hey, Austin, this is a good idea." So that is, it was late 83. We were required to produce a sample chapter, and I basically cobbled one together on Afghanistan. So we were working on that in 84, and the first edition came out in early 85. But as Jim says, we organized it as if it were a kind of intelligence briefing for a leader, and talk people through both course of action options that participants, we'd identify who they were, suggest what their aims were, and then the gaming on it was, you know, we were pretty methodical, in some cases very methodical. Didn't mean we were always right. That's not the point. Take a look at, even though we did hit some things pretty closely, but take a look at what the interests are, what they're doing, how far they might go, and then we're going to put a betting line down as to most likely outcomes. And if any of our top three occurred, for this, you know, pretty good ballpark work. Well, when the book was published, there were some people who understood what we were doing. There were some people who thought we were totally crazy, including one. I can't find this anymore. I know I had it when I moved back to Texas, because my wife and I still chuckled about it when I found it I last saw this in 92 or 93 as the Balkans were back to being aflame. But we had a chapter written in 84 and published in early 85 about Yugoslavia's looming war of breakdown, devolution. And there was it no longer exists, but there was newspaper, a financial newspaper published in Manhattan that would also review books. And a lady reviewed the book and said, "Messrs. Dunnigan and Bay are fantasists. Don't they know that the Olympics were held in Sarajevo in 1984? It's a zone of peace, you know." No, that's what she wrote. I mean, come on, we probably could dig it up, because William Morrow, I think it was Allison Brown Carrier, who was our editor on that original book, is the one who found the thing, even though I had a copy. I know I had a copy of it, because I recall looking at it on the subway in New York. But that's indicative of some other. You can say that one was out on the fringe, and it was, because the person really didn't comprehend what we were trying to do. But there were a number of other people that said, "Oh, you can't do a book like this." Well, note how the emergence, even though there were similar, I'll say, books trying to look forward and do so without a political agenda, without trying to sell a policy, which may be slightly different than having a political agenda, probably is, and provide a audience with useful tools for understanding these conflicts. Now, how does that relate to us at Strategy Page? Shoot, Jim's already hit that when you came up with it. Hey, this is what Austin and I've been doing, and Al contributing to this as well.
Yeah, and there was a young 20-something-year-old Dan Masterson that wandered into the college bookstore and bought that book and really enjoyed it. So much so it left an impression on him all the way up until 1990.
Dan, I know Al's got to get in on this, and we've been on right. and on, but here's the – Here's the point about that. I still run into people. I ran into people when I was back on active duty in Iraq in 2004 that said similar things to you. Now, it had only been out 19 years about, but same thing. Hey, Colonel Bay, I first read this when you and Dunnigan did this, you know. And sometimes some of the analytics, Jim didn't go into a game that he and I collaborated on. I did the big version of it, but he was the driving force behind it, called Arabian Nightmare, which we all did a version for ABC News Nightline in the fall of I think the show ran October 2nd or 3rd of 1990, and the game came out in December of 1990 when Jim was back to editing Strategy and Tactics. Well, I included in that a very complicated political game that most people told me was impossible to play. However, when I ended up on active duty in October of 2001, because I had gotten there, I was going to do an active duty for training 15 days at CENTCOM at MacDill, and then, of course, we had 9/11, and I was told, "You're going to get all your shots while you're here," because I was now labeled a mobilization asset. That means that means I'm liable to recall active duty. I knew that. I was there working in the J3 shop, and they had a – instead of me being there to be spun up in case of something, now I was working as an assistant J3 in CENTCOM. And son of a gun, one of their lieutenant colonels in the J5 simulations and analytics, long-range analysis section, comes in and says, "Colonel Bay, We have three copies of Arabian Nightmare, and I want to tell you that we use that political game you did to help us with some of our gaming, because it throws so many unexpected political elements into the and frustrating the military planning complex. And I said, wow, what a compliment. So the last day before I'm leaving, Dan, I could make this up, except I'm not. They had this little, it was the last day on active duty there in I forget, 18th, 19th, 20th of October 2001. We had this little ceremony that the J5 guys brought in the three copies and I autographed them. I thought that was kind of cool. But you see, there's what Jim means about some of the user level with the respect for some of these techniques.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, when I was in high school and picked up my first copy of Strategy and Tactics and started flipping through it, there were things that jumped out at me, and I know I can now take these back to Al, which is there'd be these little tidbits of information all over. And then wasn't there a section, Al, that you did that you would do these trivia like things that we now do for CIC?
Yeah.
That was FYO.
FYO, right. Yeah, we'd have half a dozen or a dozen little one-liners, basically, and then a bunch of short little essays and occasionally a long one. It was funny, I was talking to someone yesterday and explaining the approach, so to speak. The big problem that most of us had reading history, even when we were seriously into history, is assumptions. People would go on and on as if you knew what they were talking about. You know, I remember reading a naval book, and it was talking about early designs of torpedo boats. And it said, the first American torpedo boat was such and such, which was built by the Herrschaufs. Well, who the hell are the Herrschaufs? You know, but it was written as if it assumed you knew who these people were. Now, that's a very simple example, but you can go on, you know, talking about how does a musket work? And, you know, somebody talks about a 10-pounder. Well, what the hell is a 10-pounder? What does it exactly mean? If you've had experience, after a while, you'll get it. But initially, you're up a creek. So one of the purposes of FYEO and the sidebars that we began to introduce into the article.
And I wanted you to make sure that you mentioned those sidebars, because those sidebars were the things that attracted young people like me that picked up the magazine, and where all of a sudden this information jumped out at us that we had never had access to before.
Yeah, and it was information that in most books, they assumed you knew what the hell it was all about. Well, the real point was you didn't know what it was all about because you hadn't had a clue. I mean, we're Americans, so we never use the phrase pounder anymore. You know, we haven't used that for guns since well before World War II, but the Brits were still using it. And if you weren't a Brit, you wouldn't know. So that was one of the reasons for that. The other was when we were digging up material for games, sometimes it would turn out that really obscure stuff was important. Stuff that in one sense is totally unimportant was in fact very important. I don't know, maybe Jim will remember this. When ISBE did the Marne game, it was one of the most unique war games ever, since it started with nobody on the board. And then on the first turn, the French start at the top of the board, and because they're retreating, right? So they're retreating, and then the Germans come on the board, and the French retreating, and the troops begin to pour into Paris and so on. And somebody, we're playing the game, and somebody says, well, I mean, why can't the Germans attack Paris? Well, they got all the forts. Well, what about those cannons that wiped out the forts at Liège? Well, now we got to find the cannons, right? Well, it took weeks. I think 3 or 4 weeks of going to library every day and perusing histories and journals and whatnot of the period immediately, following the war, before we discovered where these cannon were. And the answer was that wherever they weren't close enough to be used if the Germans tried to attack Paris. It would have been, you know, they were busy shooting up some other place, and the Germans hadn't thought about it. Now, here's a piece of useless information, in one sense, that's extraordinarily important in designing this particular game. So what are you going to do with it?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, one of the ones that was fascinating to me, and it's actually, now there have been books written about it, but when you guys did Agincourt, you found out something weird with the how the setup would have gone if you went with the historical sources at that time, right?
There
was a map issue or something like that?
Well, there were a couple of issues. The first was the traditional accounts suggested that the English were moving forward during the battle. You know, as the French attacked them and they began hacking back and forth, you know, the traditional accounts, because the patriotic English accounts, right, are suggesting that the English, we keep tempted to say the Brits, but that's not right, are advancing as they hack away at the French. Well, that's, you know, you do a little experimentation, which we did. We had a battle in the company library to study the problem. And the English couldn't be moving forward if the French are attacking them and bodies are piling up, since the French front rank is getting slaughtered. So the French are pushing towards the English. We know that. So the English wouldn't be able to advance over the dead bodies they're piling up, and the French would have to eventually clamber over the dead guys. And that was not in any of the traditional accounts that we had ever found. You know, so that was a little bit of an interesting variation on the traditional version of the battle. Remember that, Jim?
Yes. And one thing we also pointed out was that this sort of analysis was not unique to us, of course. There was a fellow named Delbruck, which I think Al put me onto, a German historian, pre-World War I. He was actually a reserve officer and eventually led a German infantry division during the war. But he was a historian, and he basically went and tested, as we did, not for war games, but simply to find out, well, what was the truth? You know, they talk about the Persians bringing a million-man army or attacking this way and what have you. He basically got people, you know, he was a reserve officer. He had access to troops and what have you. He'd get guys, you know, carrying, you know, in terms of packs and weapon rifles, the same weight that, you know, an ancient, you know, a hoplite, you know, a Greek infantryman would. And he said, all right, run 100 yards. Let's see what happens. You know, these guys were young guys in good shape. And what happened was, you know, they weren't good for much of anything after a 100-yard dash.
Yeah.
Another thing we discovered, and again, Al put this on to me, he knew the people up at the Metropolitan Museum, you know, Military History Department. And they had this great film made in the 1920s where they got a bunch of Columbia athletes and put them in, small athletes because people had changed over the centuries, and put them into the medieval armor. You know, plate armor, stuff weighed, you know, 70, 80, 90 pounds, and wanted to see if they could jump, get on a horse and move around, and these guys could. I mean, the weight was so evenly distributed. And again, this makes sense in retrospect. The ancients were not stupid. They were practical people. You had to be practical if you wanted to live. And so they designed this armor so a guy in reasonably good shape could basically easily get on a horse. Like in one of the scenes, it is a silent movie, again, made in the 1920s, you got this kid, you know, he seems like in good shape. I don't know what his sport was, but he jumped on the horse in full armor. And then you had guys off the horse doing basically exercise, getting down on the ground, lying down, jumping up and what have you, you know, wielding the weapons or what have you. They weren't doing it like it was nothing. You could see they were making an effort, but they were not, as the conventional wisdom has come down to us, they were not, you know, stumbling around like turtles. They were flexible,
right.
They were mobile, and this basically changes the outlook on many ancient battles. You know, these guys did not need people to lift them up, you know, onto their horse. They would jump right on, even in a full suit of armor. And, of course, as Al and I went on in researching this, we found out that the most common cause of death among knights, you know, medieval warriors, you know, aristocrats and whatnot, was not on the battlefield, but in tavern brawls, you know, drunken brawls where they pull out their dirk, their knife, and somebody with knife.
Yeah.
you know, women, their wives, had a greater chance of dying, you know, young because of childbirth than their husbands did in battle. In fact, yeah. I think there was one battle I dug up where most of the casualties among the elite, the people in the full armor, were heat stroke. It was a very hot day, and these guys were in the saddle for hours, and some of them just keeled over and died from heat prostration. So, you know, by analyzing his history and asking questions, you say, well, how exactly does it work? Take nothing for granted. We stumbled yeah. across all sorts of interesting stuff, and we passed it on to our users, and we also educated thousands of people onto this technique. And, of course, people in the military recognize it because this was actually invented not for the military, but for scientific purposes, in the 1930s in Britain as operational research, which we came to call operations research, which is now the thing everybody hates that MBAs do, you know, analysis. It often comes to unpleasant results. We got to close this factory. Well, boy, I've been here 20 years. I'm sorry, we're losing money, yada, yada. And, of course, the media jumps on the side of the poor, you know, out-of-work, you know, worker, not the fact that the place is losing money. And of course, as the Soviet Union found out, you know, you can only keep that routine, you know, keeping factories going that are losing money for so long, when the whole house of cards comes down. So we basically took that analytic approach and made it palatable, you know, to absorb. You know, your average MBA will give you all sorts of metrics, charts, and what have you, and you got to understand, you know, hopefully taking a course in calculus. We realized most of our audience has not got those chops and doesn't want to go to that effort. But again, if you simply show the cause and effect, which is what those, we call the modules, those sidebars, that's what it did. It was a little database because a lot of people would just breeze through the text and the text would say, you know, take our word for it, blah, blah, blah. But if you don't take our word for it, off to the right or on the next page, there's a, you know, a full column, you know, marked up with the, you know, lines, we call the module, which explained in detail, boom, 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 how the musket actually worked, what it could do, how long it took to load it and stuff like that. Dan pointed out, young guys who knew nothing about a lot of this, you know, background, they saw, there was this eureka moment, you know, among, you know, millions of teenagers worldwide, because the strategy and tactics eventually became a hot item with English-speaking teenagers worldwide, because it wasn't just an American thing. It was basically a worldwide thing.
Go ahead. And now we see that influence actually has moved because those kids now are all my age and they're some of them are full professors at universities in England, even, that they have introduced wargaming as part of the history curriculum.
Yes, and not only that, to give credit where credit is due, at the same time we were inventing it, you know, great minds think alike. There was a movement, if you remember, in the 60s and 70s. I forget what they called it, but it's basically applying operations research to the study of history.
Yeah.
There was a term for it. Now it's accepted, but then it was revolutionary. And these guys were coming out with all sorts of, you know, things, revolutionary thoughts on her, but they were basically invulnerable because if you attack them, they said, well, here are the numbers. You know, argue with the numbers.
Right.
And they couldn't. And it was amazing. Al was deeply into that. He's the guy with the PhD in history. And so it was a movement which actually I found out started in the 19th century. The Memorial Movement, which the Germans, they had the good points, basically looking at analytics. And this is even before operations research, but after calculus was invented. You know, even then people understood that, you know, they're, if you can count it, if you can measure it, you can do a lot more with it. So it really started in the 19th century, evolved into the 20s and 30s with, you know, cybernetics, modern statistics, which was developing even then during World War II. And now, you know, in the 21st century, you know, all this stuff didn't just appear out of nowhere. It was basically very many, many people built on the efforts of people, you know, a generation or half a generation before them, and it's still going on. And so when I give my talks, I was up at the Naval War College a couple of months ago and giving a talk, and one thing I pointed out to these young guys is, look, the thing you're going to have to confront, and these were analytic types in the Navy, I says, the rapid phase of change. It's been, you know, we talked about future shock in the 1970s. Well, I've basically, calculated it, number countered it, what have you, the rate of change in technologies, and it's going to happen faster and faster and faster, and the military is already aware of the fact that it's expedient to buy technology off the shelf and, you know, put some green or blue paint on it because if they wait for the military procurement system, which still takes, you know, from the 10, 15 years to do something, the stuff is obsolete by the time the troops get it. So even the military has recognized that. And I told these Navy guys that it's only going to get worse, so to speak, or better, depending on what you do with it. And they appreciated that. Some of these guys, like Al pointed out, grew up with the war games, and some of them are second generation. Their fathers were fans of ours back in the 60s and 70s. And if the kid had the numeracy gene, he picked up, that's one of the few things he picked up from dad, maybe some of his rock and roll collection. But that was it.
Now, Al, I have one other question for you before we wrap things up. And we ask Austin how he got involved with Jim. How did you get involved with Jim?
I ran across wargaming. A friend of mine in high school, it was very funny actually, he dropped out of high school when he turned 16, lied about his age, joined the Army, had an accident, came back about 18 months later. So I was a senior, he was, you know, like a sophomore at this point. But while he was in the Army, someone had introduced him to Tactics 2. So I, you know, learned.
Charles
that
Roberts.
That was one of the first commercial war games.
And so he was really hooked on it. So I started playing Tactics 2, looked around for more stuff. You know, went to the library, said, looked up this thing, War Games, found some of the old 19th century games. New York Public Library had actual, you know, copies of some of these 19th century war games. And then, you know, checked out Avalon Hill. They were doing about a game a year, I think, in those days.
Yeah, one or two.
So I was following that up, wrote a piece for their magazine, and Victor Medea calls me up and says something about this and that and the other, and hey, how would you like to meet this guy who's doing a game for Avalon Hill? And so there it is. It's like spring of 66, I think, and I headed down to Jim's apartment, Jim's luxurious digs
in Brooklyn,
yeah, with this... He was a second-floor apartment, and out his window, the roof of the first floor went way back because there was a store down there, and that's where he was playtesting Jutland. You know, it was a good, good spot. You know, I mean, you could have the entire German fleet and British fleet playing it on the roof, right? That was about the only time the game ever got played, I think. You know,
otherwise you end up taking your fleet into the bathroom or something. That was, and we tested 90 games. There was also that air game, the Rick Tobin's, whatever we call
yes,
it, Flying
yes.
Circus.
Yeah, Flying Circus, yeah.
And yeah, that's where we got started. And then actually, when I decided to start SPI, I was working my way through college. Al had already graduated, and I needed a few bucks to buy some basic materials, like $100, which is worth like $500 or $600 today with inflation. And Al basically put up the $100, which got paid back in a couple of months, to get SPI started. By then, I got my first royalties checks from, that's really what got me through Columbia, from the games, two games I'd done for Avalon Hill, Jutland and World War II, 1914. And that and $100 from Al, you know, got us started. And the rest is history, so to speak.
Yeah. Now, you bought Strategy and Tactics. It was done as a newsletter before you bought it.
It was a magazine started by an Air Force intelligence guy, Chinese linguist and analyst. And he had started it while he was overseas. He did tours in Vietnam, and he was basically anywhere near China. They needed him to basically listen and translate what the Chinese were up to. And he started it overseas, and it was more miniatures and then, you know, some board games, the games we were doing. And but he couldn't make a go of it. And he was looking to either shut it down or get rid of it. And I basically, again, absorbed the, like we did with FYO later, absorbed his, subscription obligations and took it over. And then our first edition of Modern Strategy Tactics, which was 19 in the series, you know, Chris, the original publisher, had done 18 before us, was done in September 1969. And it had a game in it. And that's what revolutionized it because, like, Al pointed out, Avalon Hill only did the game one or two games a year. And after a couple of years, we were doing 30 or 40 games a year. So you can see where we got our popularity from. quantity, if not always quality.
One thing I think is worth thinking about. People's not knowing about a lot of this sort of, you know, material is very strongly influenced by things like the movies. You know, in the movies, the guy pulls the pin out of the grenade with his teeth, you know? And, well, it looks good in the movies, but that doesn't really work very well.
Yeah. That's one thing I picked up. I had been in the Army. I got out in 63. And I'll never forget going through basic, and all of our instructors were basically World War II or Korean War combat veterans, because these guys had stayed in, and they all started getting out in the mid-60s. I was in 61 to 63. So this was a golden age, you know, for people in basic training, because you've got people who'd been there. They have plenty of experience. And they keep yelling at us, I don't want any of this John Wayne shit. And they were basically complaining, like Al was saying, all these idiotic things they do in the movies. You say, that doesn't work on the battlefield. You do what John Wayne does, it'll get you killed for real. You know, you won't get up and dust yourself off and go off to craft services for a free meal. They were all onto that, because apparently in the Korean War, they had a lot of draftees, because they had all these rah-rah, you know, movies coming out in and right after World War II. And apparently a lot of young teenage guys saw that and said, that's what war is like. And they ran it through basic and sent them off to Korea. And they didn't realize they had to basically desensitize them, you know, or debrief them, as it were, wean them away from the fantasy war that Hollywood put out versus the real one. And a lot of guys, you know, they found out that these guys, especially in Korea, they basically went, I don't know if any of you tried to pull it. You learn that in basic, that doesn't work. You can't pull a pin out with your teeth. But simply, you know, not taking cover, not keeping your ass down, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of guys got killed because they just didn't know any better. And so by the 1960s, you had years of basically drill sergeants being told, as if they needed any prompting, that damn it, you know, get rid of the John Wayne shit. I don't want any more guys going into combat thinking they're John Wayne, because they ain't. They'll be dead if they try to.
Yeah.
We've used a lot of our time and gone double what we normally go.
We only do it every 15 years, so I think.
We only do it every 15
right, Dan,
years.
Dan, let me add a couple of things to the discussion.
Okay.
Coming up on this. Jim mentioned Hans Delbruck on this. And Al has a good rap about the importance of Delbruck and quantitative history, but Delbruck was a reserve officer in the Franco-Prussian War, and where he got his insight, I mean, the guy was a superb professor, researcher, and historian. By the way, I use his Warfare in Antiquity, where a lot of these techniques are used, which was published, I think, in 1900. I use it in the strategy and strategic theory class I teach at the University of Texas right now, in part because Delbruck asks these kind of hard analytic questions. And Jim was mentioning the film that he and Al saw with Columbia students. Delbruck in the 19th century gets some graduate students to put on Athenian armor and try and replicate the phalanx assault at Marathon. And it's a test for the same kind of thing. Can people in very good shape, young soldiers now, and they might even be better shape statistically than the Athenians, some of the Athenians. Remember, the Athenian phalanx was put together out of the people. They were guys were traders and teachers and the like, and very well drilled. Very well drilled, but nevertheless, Delbruck would do that. Delbruck's important, but some of the roots of some of the things we do, and the reason I'm saying this is because we do have these. There is an audience out there that's called deep news or deep news diving, and I really think strategypage.com is a premier example of this. Maybe this is a way that for the next 5 to 10 years we shape ourselves. But Aristotle. Now, three parts of the Politics are actually devoted to Aristotle's analysis of the way Greek city-states really work. And you can see, I was thinking about this when we put together the first edition of A Quick and Dirty Guide to War. I don't know that I talked with Jim about it, but Aristotle talks about the demographics, the economics, the political structures of Greek city-states, and he's still got one of the best pieces of advice for anybody who wants to run a clean company country. I forget which book it's probably in six. Al probably knows. Al's correct me on this, but it's he says you've got to have accountants to oversee the guys who are doing the public financing. Well, good gosh, corruption plays a role in almost every single ongoing conflict on this planet right now. All right, Tacitus is someone else comes up in. Now I use Tacitus's part of his introduction to the Roman Wars with the Germans, because he really operates a little bit as an anthropologist. He talks about the social structure of the German tribes, how they armed themselves. And, he, of course, some of his sources were essentially Roman army intelligence, who knew what these guys were up to. And Tacitus doesn't make any bones about it. He just writes very, very well. But then there's another fellow that I think Al knows I do this. I'm a fan of the Arab scholar and writer Ibn Khaldun. Now, he's sometimes given credit for inventing a social history. That's something Jim Dunnigan is very interested in. But
wait, Austin, one second.
Yeah,
Dan,
yeah.
I got to run. I'm okay.
Well, my point on this is that that some of the things, when we move to the heavy stuff with operations research, and as Jim says, there are all these analytic techniques that are there that are done. We've also got these deep historical models.
Right.
That we really do.
Well, one of the things that I would encourage as we wrap things up here, encourage people to do is, Al, a lot of the books that these guys have written are still available online, either used or they're still in their being printed. But two of the books I enjoyed the most that gave me a great tight overview of the Waterloo campaign and the Gettysburg campaign are Al Nofi's books.
Thank you.
On that. And they use the techniques that were used in strategy and tactics with the sidebars and interesting issues. And you'll find, those of you that don't look at CIC, Al's section, you should really go there. There's always fascinating tidbits and pieces of history. And Al, we're closing in on having done 500 of these over the years. So, and we'll be... I guess we'll continue as long as you continue to write them.
Well,
always reading Austin's column on contemporary stuff in our.
Hey, Dan, let me recommend Al's short but really useful book on the Alamo. Now, I'm assuming that's still in print because the last time I was at the Alamo, it uses Al. May I say this? Very Hans Delbruck type analysis on the Alamo, and it's I know folks that regard it as the little gem that it is. It is it's a neat little book and a quick read too.
And that's the great thing about all of Al's stuff is you can probably read it in a couple of evenings and get very good and a great overview of what happened in these different campaigns.
The purpose of those books was to be an introduction, because if you're kind of a layman and you sort of, hey, it's the 100th anniversary of the Civil War, and you hear something about, say, Gettysburg in the news, I wonder what if you go and look for books, you're liable to get an outstanding book that is just totally out of your league, because you're a layman. And so that whole series was done that way. And I can't think of his name, Bateman. A fellow named Bateman, earlier this year, did a series for, was it Esquire or New Yorker, on the Battle of Gettysburg. And his last chapter was 10 books you should read about Gettysburg. And he put my book in the list. And he got it exactly right. He said, This is the best introduction. That's all it is. It's an introduction to the Battle of Gettysburg.
Yeah, but look, let's. I'm if I sound like an Al Nofi fan, let me be one. I am one. The thing is, though, Al, you're right, but take the Alamo book as an example.
Yeah.
The material is so solid. It is the work. It's solid research work supporting it. So in the introduction, you're not getting somebody you're writing something that really does prepare reader to move on to something else if he or she wants to. You know,
that's really the point. Making, I'm a professional historian, and I'm not writing the book for other historians. I'm writing it, for a high school level, person, which is about the average reading level in America. And explaining stuff that you don't necessarily think of. There's so many common... I mean, even I get caught by commonplaces sometimes because you see it and you don't think about it. And then later on, you're researching it and you realize, what the hell is this, and it's something that everybody knows about back then. like cavalry officers. Part of the training of cavalry officers was to be able to examine the grass and determine how many hours the horses would need to graze by the character of this grass. Now, so when somebody is saying, Lieutenant so-and-so led a patrol to find a good campsite, all right, we're thinking water and, defensive position. Well, yeah. Grass too, because you want the horses to eat a little bit of grass in addition to their dry rations, so that you can stretch the dry rations. Something we would never think of today.
but it actually affects operations. Dan, I know this is. If folks are still with us, then you must be dedicated Strategy Talk listeners, and thank you for being so. But one of the reasons I went ahead and took the moment to, because Jim did bring up Delbrook, and I went in and I took several examples of historians that use many of these techniques, and they are the classics. They're the ones that people still go back to. And when Al says, his books are very, useful introductions, our site is an introduction to the complexities out there. And, we don't always get it right. That's not the point totally with what we're trying to do. We're trying to help inform and prepare and give insights. And that was Dunnigan's idea with strategy and tactics as well. Mm-hmm. It was so.
Mm-hmm. Right.
All right, guys.
One little anecdote?
You bet.
The persistence of received wisdom. When Hans is laying out his evidence that the Greeks could not possibly have charged over a mile at a full charge.
Hans Delbrück.
Hans Delbrück. Yeah. Somewhat. One of the criticisms raised against him was, and this is actually cited in print, was that he is ignoring the influence of the gods who were fighting on the side of the Greeks that day. Well, but, people will accept this received, wisdom. Anyway, have a good one.
Hey, take care, guys.
We'll talk to you all later.
Bye.
All right, take care.